Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome back to syndicatednews.net. Tonight, we're interviewing Dr. Glenn Caddy. This is a very special guest. Dr. Glenn Caddy is a clinical and forensic psychologist and a specialist in behavioral medicine. In addition, he's published over 5 books and over 100 professional referee journals. He works out of Fort Lauderdale, Florida, and he consults nationally here in the United States, but internationally as well. He's board certified in clinical psychology, forensic psychology, behavioral medicine, and human sexuality. He holds fellowship status in 3 of the 4 boards. He's also certified as a national custody evaluator. Dr. Caddy, are you with us?
I am.
Welcome to syndicatednews.net. And Dr. Caddy consults for families, attorneys, and does a lot of forensic work. For those of you needing a consultant, his email address is Glenn, that's G-L-E-N-N, dot Caddy, C-A-D-D-Y, at gmail.com. And you can reach him by phone at 954-547-5100. Dr. Caddy, let's talk about parental alienation this evening. What exactly is PAS from a mental health field perspective?
Parental alienation syndrome is a concept that's been developed in particular over the last 15 years. It emerges when you have a conflict between parents in which the child or children become the pawns in the conflict, and where one of the parents, called the inducer or the alienator, seeks to victimize the other parent by using the children as weapons in the conflict between them. Now, parental alienation syndrome is more than parental alienation, because one can attempt to alienate a child or children against another parent, and you may succeed or you may not succeed. Parental alienation syndrome is the syndrome or the constellation of mental health elements in the functioning of the child or children that demonstrates that the alienation efforts have been successful. And the more profound that success, the more alienation, and the more severe the parental alienation syndrome becomes. The syndrome is not simply one or two particular symptoms. It can represent a whole constellation of different attitudes, opinions, values, and behaviors that children engage in as a result of their mind being effectively controlled and manipulated against a parent by another parent. And in most instances, the success of that alienation occurs over a long and protracted period of time, where often the other parent, the victim parent, has limited or in many instances no access to the children whatsoever. So it's ultimately a mental health outcome for the child or a mental illness outcome, because it's a process that although the alienating parent perhaps has no ultimate intention of really damaging the child, but rather simply getting back at or controlling the other parent, the net effect often is that what we really have here is the development in the child or children of a delusional disorder or a mixed delusional disorder with other conditions. And that delusional disorder involves their distorted beliefs regarding the other parent. There's a concept in psychology called shared delusional disorder. This concept has been around a long time. It goes back to the 18th century French, where they referred to the concept as the folie de famille. And what they were referring to was the notion that a family member can induce in another family member a mental illness by either copying or mind controlling And there we weren't necessarily talking about parental alienation. We were talking about the induction of a delusion. But in essence, what we have in parental alienation is the evolution of a specific delusion or set of delusions around, induced by one parent in regard to the evils or the inappropriateness of the victim parent. And these conditions can have very long-term and lasting, often permanent consequences for children.
Excellent. Dr. Caddy, Brazil, as a result of the Goldman case, in which a Brazilian wife who had married an American took the child to Brazil and divorced her husband from Brazil through the mail, and then refused to come back with the child, remarried someone else, and then died in childbirth. And the father fought for years to get that child back. The president of Brazil signed into law a bill making it a federal crime to alienate a child from the parent. It's the first country in the world to have done that. What do you think? Is that a good move, or do you see that that's going to be happening in all countries?
Well, I think that certainly there needs to be international agreements reached between countries. It may be that it doesn't operate exactly. I'm not sure of the mechanism that ought to be in place. But, you know, we can extradite people for crimes from various countries around the world back here, and we are obliged under treaty in the United States to extradite individuals for various sorts of crimes. The alienation of a child and the removal from a jurisdiction is really kidnapping by a parent, and I see absolutely no reason why that shouldn't be criminalized. In my view, it's only by elevating the event to a crime that in many instances the parent victim will ever be able to see the child again. The task of trying to locate somebody internationally and secret the child away, or hire a crew of people to try and re-kidnap the person back, that's a task that's typically way beyond the average family member whose child is stolen internationally. And I think that however we do it, I certainly would recommend that we start to place a priority on this entire issue. Interestingly, if somebody else stole the child, a non-custodial parent or a stranger child stole the child, then we would bring tremendous resources to bear. I see no reason why we shouldn't bring equal resources to bear when the child is stolen by a parent.
And what are the impacts on the children of these sorts of alienation phenomena?
It varies, obviously, from child to child, from circumstance to circumstance, from family to family. But let's be clear that they are never good. And it really depends on how extreme these events ultimately occur. I'm aware, for example, of one case at the moment where a parent, in this case a mother, hid children away from a father, relocated several times around the country, created fake birth certificates, created fake social security cards through photocopying and the use of a computer, so changed the names, the birth dates, the social security numbers of the children, and for more than 12 years, I think it was 12 years anyway, 11 or 12 years, father was not able to access his children. Eventually, as a result of a tip that went to him by somebody who knew the mother and the family, he was ultimately able to reconnect with his children. But he had two boys, and they were 11 years older, and it can be very devastating. There are some children who seem to make a fair adjustment in alienation, but it's an adjustment based on a lie. It's based on the premise that either my parent hates me, my father or my mother, whoever the estranged person is, hates me or hates my other parent, wants to harm me, will kill my mother or my father, if they ever, or will harm me, will sexually abuse me as they are allegedly to have done before, or my sister. And so you start off with with firstly the distortion of the entire belief systems of the child, that reality is not reality, their reality is not the truth. Secondly, you've got a situation in which a child does not have the benefit of the rearing experience of a person who may be an absolutely excellent parent. And so it's as if that parent died in many respects. But when that person dies, there's a natural grieving and there's not all of the other pathology that we see in parental alienation. I have certainly seen cases of parental alienation occurring at age 6 and 7 where the child was alienated from, one case I'm thinking of, the child was removed to Canada and hidden in Canada for extended periods. The child lived down in, the other parent lived in Florida, and it took years for this child to surface. Now, in this particular case, the mother didn't have the financial resources to continue to try and find the child, but eventually the child showed up almost on her doorstep. That child was seriously involved in drug abuse. The father had committed sexual behavior against the child. The father had provided the child with substantial amounts of money to go and get him drugs that she was then able to share. It went on and on and on and on and on. That child, she's now about 24, 25 years of age. She has very little resources. She never had. She's a reasonably bright girl. Never got to college. Only scraped through high school. It just does not have any meaningful advantages in life in the way that she otherwise may have had. There are two other children in the family, and neither of those children were exposed to the sort of hideousness that the father engaged in with this successfully alienated child. Two other children weren't willing to go with the father, and they are doing fine. The poor kid who was alienated, her life has been pretty miserable. So, in one way or another, I've seen everything from attempted suicides, drug abuse, constantly failed relationships, major difficulties with the consequences of children who have been mistreated in a variety of alienation contexts.
And I wanted to ask you about the role of the legal system in failing to better manage the alienation process. Could you give us some information on that? All parents ask me about that.
Why don't we start off by sort of the hideous paradox that from a legal standpoint, there isn't parental alienation unless there's money. And I don't mean to be vulgar in that sort of directive, but the fact is that the way these cases get into the legal system is only as a result of money, because it takes so much money often to deal with the complexities of these sorts of legal cases. They are difficult cases to deal with. They require really competent and experienced lawyers who understand what it's all about. They also require the hiring of very skilled mental health experts in order to deal with the complexities and the realities of these cases. And they require skilled judges who get it and who are prepared to act definitively to shut down the capacity of the alienating parent to continue to damage the child at the expense of the victim parent. There is a tremendous tendency, in my professional opinion, in the legal community, for them to really do a very compromised through hideous job in parental alienation. The judges are reticent to believe that something can be as bad as it can be, or they seem to be motivated to allow the situation, the legal process, to go through the normal channels of slow, sort of moving, where the job of the lawyer representing the victim often doesn't get better represented than the perpetrator. And so the legal system tends to seek to undermine the significance of, or deny the significance of the alienation by saying things like, the children don't want to see their father. The children believe that the father has abused them, or the children don't want to see their mother. They believe that the mother has been sexually vile with one of them, or has done misdeeds in front of the children, and on and on and on. And the problem, of course, is that some of the alienators are absolutely credible. They are pathological enough to act as if they truly believe everything that they're saying. And they've said it over and over so many times in many instances in the legal process that they become truly talented at telling one story after another. And the judiciary are not lie detectors. If we were dealing with a criminal case, it would be a lot easier. The person who is judged to have done the misdeed gets thrown in jail. Even when we establish that the misdeed has been done here, in the case of parental alienation, there's a tendency that many judiciary have to want to take a very soft approach to the problem and ask people in a rational way to stop doing that, sort of slap their hand, and they may make some changes in the custody process or in the scheduling of visitation, et cetera, but it's a rare judge who really gets it in the extreme cases and take very definitive action to totally shut down access to the alienating parent. If the judiciary doesn't take a definitive stand in protecting the children and in protecting them against the perpetrator of the victimization, and that means shutting that relationship down until therapeutic intervention can recommend its reestablishment, then we are never going to really solve this problem by being mealy-mouthed and sort of, oh, well, let's just restructure a little bit of the visitation, et cetera, et cetera. What we have to understand is that damage that can happen to a child through alienation is just as serious as the damage that can happen to a child through sexual abuse. And yet, if somebody is engaged in sexual abuse, that relationship will be shut down instantly and until it can be established that the parent who's the alleged perpetrator no longer constitutes a risk to the child. That strategy is simply not invoked in the vast number of cases in parental alienation, and as a result therefrom, the system just drags on and on and on endlessly. I've been involved in cases where the duration of the alienation exceeded 12 years and where there was court action through much of those 12 years, but the action was never definitive and never effective. I've been involved in cases where there are four or five different judges that recuse themselves over periods of 7, 8 years, 10 years. And still the cases go on. The children continue to get older, and the children still have either limited or virtually no access, or they shut down completely and they refuse to have anything to do with the person who ultimately is the alienated victim, the parent who's the alienated victim. These issues are really tragic, and the judiciary needs a great deal of education to come to terms with the importance of treating this matter with the seriousness that it deserves, as opposed to, oh, well, it's really only just a little family squabble. It is not. It is dramatic in its impact on children.
Dr. Caddy, I had three more questions, but you answered them all one in a row. It was amazing.
Oh, my goodness.
It's wonderful. One thing I wanted to ask you, it's the last one that we wanted to cover, treatment considerations in extreme cases. Is it right that this parallels with cult behavior?
Yes, the most effective strategy in dealing with the seriously alienated child is pretty much exactly the same sort of thing that we would do in a person who had been captured and brought into a cult, or perhaps also a person who had been subjected to criminal capture, kidnap, and over a period of time was indoctrinated by a cult action. Many of you might know about the case of Patty Hearst back in the early 1970s. A newspaper heiress who at age 22 or 23 was a college student, and she was captured by a group who called themselves the Symbionese Liberation Army.
Yes.
Within a number of months, Patty Hearst started wielding a gun in a bank robbery in which a woman was killed. And when Ms. Hearst was ultimately captured, she was convicted of the crime, of her role in the crime, and spent significant time in prison and then in rehabilitation until ultimately, I believe, that was President Bill Clinton who pardoned her. Having said that, this was a woman whose life was changed by the manipulation of a group in which she was involved. There's also a concept that's referred to as the Stockholm Syndrome. In the Stockholm Syndrome, you have a captured person who starts to identify themselves with the perpetrators of their capture. They start to appreciate the fact that these people are letting them live, that they're allowing them to have water, that they're being nice to them, that they are telling them that they won't be killed so long as certain things happen. And you often get a sense of the victims in starting to identify with the perpetrators when the emotions are profound enough. You get, in the case of parental alienation, what ultimately happens is that the bifurcation of the belief systems of the children becomes so extreme that they believe that pretty much everything that they're told by the inducing parent about the victim parent. And that's not all that different from the way cults occur, the way cults influence people to change from their love for their parents, for example, to their belief that the only survival for them is in the cult. And of course, we know from, for example, Jim James' events in Guyana, where more than 1,100 people died as a result of participating in the Jamestown massacre in the cult of Jim James. And we also know that some 40 people died in San Francisco in what was called the Heaven's Gate cult, when they believed that they needed to commit suicide in order to be able to climb into a space capsule that was traveling behind the Halley's Comet. I mean, some amazing distortions of reality, but people are capable of manipulating people's minds on some occasions to create that. And when the person is a parent, they have inordinately additional initial authority. And tragically, sometimes that authority is used for great evil. So now, in lesser cases, of course, what we do is we don't deprogram. We don't have to fully deprogram. Whereas we don't have to remove the children or child or children from the environment that they were in, relocate them to a totally different hospital environment, intensive program of therapy, of inpatient care, or if not in a hospital, in some sort of escape retreat type environment, where the person who's doing the deprogramming works with individually each child as well as collectively, if there are two or three children, collectively all three, or between two children together, and they work towards establishing a leader in the children group who will ultimately align with their perspective about the goodness of the victimized parent while not really trying to criticize the perpetrating parent, and slowly move these children back to an opening to recognize that they not only do love the victim parent, but they have always loved him or her, while nevertheless developing this distorted belief that the person was somehow bad, hideous, had done something terrible to them. All of these beliefs that have been formed over a very long period of time can take quite a while to dissolve. And the process of that dissolution takes as long as it takes, just as is the case in the deprogramming of a cult victim.
And I noticed that one of the well-known psychologists in child and teenage behavior now has a program to help deprogram children who suffer from PAS. I was very impressed with that. And what touched me was that a judge in a court in Canada approved a child being brought from Canada to the United States to be deprogrammed of
to
PAS.
Be deprogrammed.
I was so impressed.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Caddy, I can't thank you enough for coming to syndicatednews.net and sharing all your knowledge. And I understand you have a gift for anyone who calls you or emails you. And again, let me give that information. Dr. Caddy can be reached at glenn.caddy@gmail.com. That's glenn.caddy@gmail.com. And his phone number is 954-547-5100.
Yes, and we might as well tell your audience what the gift is, and that is that I am making a series of tickets available to the Canadian Symposium for Parental Alienation that is being held in New York City from October the 2nd through October the 3rd of this year. The tickets normally are several hundred dollars, and I've been authorized by the board members to make available certain free ticket opportunities for anybody who would like to learn more about parental alienation and attend the second Canadian Symposium for Parental Alienation Syndrome being held again October the 2nd and 3rd of 2010 in New York City. And I can provide you with all of the information of that conference. So if you'd like to give me a call or email me, I'll be happy to send you that information.
Thank you, Dr. Caddy. We can't thank you enough. This is such a serious matter, and it's affecting families worldwide. We can't thank you enough for coming to syndicatednews.net. Again, That's Dr. Glenn Caddy at glenn.caddy@gmail.com, and his phone number is 954-547-5100. And he's making tickets available to anyone that calls him that heard it on syndicatednews.net. You'll have your free ticket if you give him a call or an email. Isn't that wonderful? Thank you so much for being so gracious. We so appreciate you.
Thank you for having me very, very much. Bye-bye now.
Thank you, and that's a wrap.